Good evening, everyone. This morning we begin to talk about the question of why don't you use instruments in music, a question that we are very often asked by visitors who come into our services here, and as we have opportunity to teach other people, this issue of instrumental music comes up. I'd like to begin tonight to continue our discussion of that subject by noting with you this letter that Governor Pliny of Bithynia, around AD 115, wrote to Emperor Trajan, the Emperor of Rome. And he wrote this after interviewing some of these strange people with a strange new religion, Christianity. And he described them like this. The Christians affirmed that they were in the habit of meeting on a certain fixed day before it was light, when they sang in alternate verses a hymn to Christ as to a god, and bound themselves by a solemn oath not to do any wicked deed, after which it was their custom to separate and then reassemble to partake of food, but food of an ordinary and innocent kind. This is, of course, just a secular source, but it reinforces the idea that we saw in this morning's lesson. Even when you look at the apostolic writings, the writings of the first century apostles, there's no evidence at all that they were using instruments of music in their worship. They were singing hymns as part of their worship, but no indication at all that they were using instruments. And even Pliny's letter to Emperor Trajan certainly gives no evidence that there were instruments of music being used. And as we said this morning, what really makes that stand out is that instruments of music were a very integral part of Greco-Roman worship in the pagan temples, and certainly an integral part of the worship of Yahweh at the Jerusalem temple as part of that Old Covenant Mosaic system. And so it certainly is striking then that you see the apostles apparently not teaching these first century Christians to use instruments of music in worship or to accompany their songs with that kind of instrumental music. Instead, the kind of worship that the first century Christians were engaging in, very plain kind of worship, singing, without some kind of extra adornment to make it a more complex thing, like the kind of entertainment music that people were used to in that Greco-Roman world, and also in their own Greco-Roman pagan worship. But instead, very simple kind of worship. And as we suggested this morning, that would certainly comport with the concept that Jesus taught in John chapter 4 about the new covenant worship being a worship of spirit and or in spirit and truth, wherein you have the heart of an individual who is expressing himself to God, and there's not some other kind of trappings associated with that, but that very simple kind of basic worship, one spirit communing with God, who himself is spirit. So the fundamental reason, I would affirm, why it's not appropriate for us to worship God today with instruments of music is because the apostles were not teaching that as part of first century worship. And I would just say to you that it makes no difference whether you're talking about worshiping here in a church building or whether you're at home and you're worshiping. The point is, we need to worship the way that the first century Christians worshiped and worship in accordance with that apostolic teaching. And the things that we have listed here on the chart are the things that were done in worship in the first century, but no mechanical instruments of music. Now, sometimes people have challenged that statement and have asked this question. They say, does the Greek word solo in Ephesians 5:19, doesn't it mean to play an instrument? And when you look at Ephesians 5:19, and we read those verses in this morning's lesson, where Paul talks about singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord. And the Greek word that is used there is the Greek word solo. And so people very often will affirm that the word solo was a Greek word that meant to pluck a harp. And so it's a term that inherently is referring to the use of a stringed instrument of music. Well, the fact of the matter is that people who make that statement are exactly correct It's just that they haven't realized the fact that the word solo used to mean that centuries before the New Testament time, but not in New Testament times. They're absolutely correct about the word solo meaning originally centuries before the time of the gospel. It meant to pluck a stringed instrument. But words evolve. Words change in their meaning. And it is well understood that by the first century, the Greek word solo had evolved in its meaning and did not mean to pluck a stringed instrument, but was simply by that time a word that referred to making melody with your voice or singing. In fact, some people maybe are not aware of just how much languages evolve and words change meaning. Even our English language, are you aware of the fact that, have you ever had someone say, well, you know, that's an awful person? Or my kids used to say, he made an awful face at me. Well, of course, they mean something negative by that. They mean that, you know, that kid made some kind of a derogatory look or something, you know, an awful face at me. Well, of course, the word awful originally meant full of awe. And so it would be wrong for then another child to say, I wasn't making an awful face at you. I was meaning I was full of awe at you. I was admiring you. No, that's not how that word has come to evolve. The word girl in English. When we think of the word girl, that refers to a young female, right? Well, are you aware of the fact that if you go way back in our language, the word girl used to refer to a young person of either sex? So languages evolve. The word bravery, we think of bravery, well, that's somebody who's not a coward, you know, right? Faces death without fear and all that kind of thing. But if you go back early enough, the word bravery originally meant someone who was really a coward, who was putting on a false guise, but he really was a coward. But that word has now evolved and changed meaning. The exact same thing has happened with the Greek word solo. And so, yes, prior to the time of the New Testament, the Greek word did refer to plucking an instrument, but it certainly did not carry that meaning by the first century. And let me tell you what's the ultimate evidence to you for that. And if ever you're having a discussion with somebody about this, here's really all you need to really show them to prove that point. How's it translated in your versions? Open up your Bible. I don't care what version you want to use. I don't know of any modern English version that comes to Ephesians 5:19 and does not translate solo in that verse to sing or to make melody. Nobody translates that to pluck a stringed instrument. Because it's clear that that's not what Paul was talking about. He was talking about them singing and making melody with their heart. In fact, if by chance there is any kind of a wordplay that Paul might be making on the earlier use of the word solo, he's talking about making melody, making song with the instrument of your heart. You know, maybe Paul might be making that allusion. But if he is, that's the point that he's making. And you see that by looking at any version. No version says that Paul says to sing and pluck a stringed instrument with your heart. That's not what the passage says. And no translator ever tries to translate it that way. So again, what you see in all this is that there's just no indication at all that first century apostolic worship made use of instruments of music in their worship. And I want to say to you that this is not a debated point today. Secular historians understand this. Ralph P. Martin, in his book Worship in the Early Church, makes this statement. And this is representative, what you'd see in a lot of history works. Very little information is supplied to us in the New Testament about the outward forms which were in use in early Christian worship services. The use of musical instruments is a case in point. While there are allusions made to certain instruments, for example, the harp or lyre, the pipe, the cymbal, the trumpet, Paul makes allusions to those to illustrate various points, say in 1 Corinthians. But Martin goes on to say, there is no certainty that any of these were actually used in the Christian worship. The balance of probability is against such a use. And I would just say to you that virtually no one tries to argue any differently, because it's just so well understood that Christian worship in the first century did not use these mechanical instruments of music like you had in the Greco-Roman world, like you had in that Jerusalem temple. And as we saw this morning, and I gave you just a few quotes, I'll just give you a couple just to remind you of this. The early Christian writers, they're making the same point as some of those new converts to Jesus Christ out of their Greco-Roman world were trying to just kind of use some of the instruments that they used in their Greek and Roman worship to use that in the Christian assemblies. And so Justin Martyr said in AD 140, the use of singing with instrumental music was not received in the Christian churches as it was among the Jews in their infant state, but only the use of plain song. Musical organs pertain to the Jewish ceremonies and agree no more to us than circumcision. Or again, Clement of Alexandria said, and he's responding to, and this to me is important, it's why I emphasize this, they were seeing that people in their day were trying to incorporate the kind of instruments that were from their Greco-Roman world in secular entertainment or in their own pagan temples, trying to incorporate some of that in their Christian worship services. And so Clement of Alexandria makes this statement, leave the pipe to the shepherd, the flute to the men who are in fear of gods and are intent on their idol worshiping. Such musical instruments must be excluded from our wineless feasts. And again, he means as opposed to the wine-filled drunken feasts of the pagans. But as for us, we make use of one instrument alone, the word of peace, by whom we pay homage to God, no longer with ancient harp or trumpet or drum or flute. So I want you to see from all of this that this point that we're making is a point that was discussed centuries ago and has always been discussed whenever people were trying to go back to the original apostolic worship. And whenever there were changes from that, you'd have people like the ones I've showed you here who would say, wait a minute, well, that's not what was done in the apostles' day. And why are you trying to incorporate something that men use into that which God had established? So here's the question that people then ask. Well, when were musical instruments introduced into Christian worship? And I mean by that, when were they introduced and accepted? You know, I just showed you some excerpts from these early Christian writers who were criticizing those of their day, who tried to bring in some of those instruments. But when were musical instruments introduced into Christian worship and accepted? And I think a lot of people in our day and time who, you know, when they think of a church service, they think of a big organ, they think of a piano, they think of instruments on a stage and a band and all that kind of thing. And a lot of people in our day just assume that all of that has always been the case. Not only was it not the case in apostolic times, but the use of instruments even down through history, by no means was this some kind of a common thing. In fact, it was in AD 670, the 7th century, when Pope Vitalianus brought an organ into a Roman Catholic church. And that began to be a staple then in that Roman Catholic church there in Rome. In AD 812, a Catholic cathedral in France brings for the first time an organ into its cathedral worship. And that becomes an accepted part of their worship. But it was not something that happened without criticism. Thomas Aquinas said this, commenting about these kind of musical innovations in the worship of the church. He said this in AD 1260. The church does not use musical instruments such as the harp or lyre when praising God, in case she should seem to fall back into Judaism. Instruments usually move the soul more to pleasure than create inner moral goodness. Now, Thomas Aquinas was not against instruments of music in the secular
realm and for enjoyment and entertainment. But he's just saying when it comes to the worship, the instrument of music is not something that affects a person's heart and teaches a person's heart like the words of a song that communicate truths to us. Somebody playing on a flute or playing a tambourine or a lyre, that's not something that teaches us and admonishes us. And that's the point that Thomas Aquinas was making. That's the point that all of these writers that I'm showing excerpts from are making. But as you go to the 15th and 16th centuries, this is when the organ begins to gain prominence in Roman Catholic churches. And then after the organ had gained prominence throughout the Roman Catholic world in the 15th and 16th centuries, other instruments of music begin to be added also. And in the 16th century, when the Protestant Reformation was in full swing, instrumental music became an issue among Protestant reformers. Because they're trying to get people to go back to how things were before and the way the Catholic Church had corrupted things from apostolic times, that's what they're then appealing to. That these instruments of music are not something that was part of original apostolic worship. Erasmus said this in the early 16th century. I want you to think carefully about his comment. Modern church music is so constructed that the congregation cannot hear one distinct word. The choristers themselves do not understand what they are singing. Yet according to priests and monks, it constitutes the whole of religion. Why will they not listen to Paul? In college or monastery, it is still the same. Instrumental music, nothing but instrumental music. There was no such music in Paul's time. He goes on to say this: we have introduced into churches a type of laborious and theatrical music, a confused chattering of diverse voices, such as I do not think was ever heard in the theaters of the Greeks or the Romans. They perform everything with slide trumpets, trombones, cornets, and little flutes. And with these, the voices of men contend. Men run to church as to a theater to have their ears tickled. Now, I don't want anyone to misunderstand. I'm not showing you these excerpts from ancient writers commenting on this because somehow they constitute some authority. That's not my point. But I am showing you this for a couple of reasons. One is, as I suggested this morning, there are so many people in this generation who have the idea, because they're ignorant of history, they have the idea that this instrumental music issue, well, somehow Churches of Christ started that in the 18th and 19th centuries. That's not true. This has always been an issue, as I've said, whenever people have thought about, well, here's what was going on in the Apostles' day, and here's what's going on in our day, and the two just don't mesh. The other reason why I show you, especially this quote from Erasmus, is because I think it illustrates so well what so many of these men are talking about, is what people are doing is they are turning the simple worship that God established in order to have singing that would appeal to our hearts, they're turning that into a more complex kind of worship that's more entertaining. And as he talks about here, they are drawing all of these things from what they would see among secular music in the theaters for entertainment purposes, and you've got the orchestras with all these instruments. He's even talking also about the fact that even some of the vocal music with all the different kinds of parts is so ornate that you can't even really understand what everybody's singing at the same time. There's no way you can understand the words and be edified and taught by the things that are being said. And so all this kind of thing is something that you would see in the secular world, in the theaters, and it's entertaining and all that, and people are trying to bring that into the worship in the Lord's church. And that's what he's responding to. I think he's making a very, very good point. And let me make this observation. You know, in our day and time,
We've got, in fact, you see signs on church buildings advertising their worship. You can have the traditional worship service or what? The contemporary worship service. And what's the point of all that? Well, okay, the traditional worship service, it's not as entertaining. It's more boring. And, you know, so let's have the contemporary worship. And so now you have the bands and all these kinds of things and with all their various musical instruments, all drawn from that secular world to make it more exciting and more entertaining, musically, a more complex kind of thing. And what Erasmus is showing us here is this problem with contemporary worship. Guess what? He was wrestling with that in the 16th century. This isn't solely a modern day problem. It is a modern day problem, but it didn't start with us. Always been an issue where people have tried to just kind of alter and make the worship of God something that's more appealing to our personal senses than really what God's original purpose was. Ulrich Zwingli said this, "Everything which is added to the true institutions of Christ is an abuse." He said that around 1525. Again, this was an issue. Those Protestant reformers were trying to address this. Not all of them now. Not all the Protestant reformers were having a problem. Some, like Martin Luther, some of those Protestants were saying, well, we don't have to go all the way back to the apostolic period and do it exactly the way the apostles did. But, you know, the inconsistencies that there is what people like Zwingli and Erasmus and these were trying to point out. John Calvin, I had to show you this because, you know, I've been ridiculing John Calvin in our class this morning and about Calvinism and all that. And I think we need to show the error of that Calvinistic thinking. But not everything Calvin said was terrible. Here's what Calvin said about 1550. He said, among the other things which are appropriate for recreating man, that is the recreation of man and giving him pleasure, music is either the first or one of the principal, and we must value it as a gift of God deputed to that use. But he goes on to say this. There is a great difference between the music which one makes to entertain men at table and in their homes and the psalms which are sung in the church in the presence of God and his angels. Well, I didn't mean to go there yet. You see the point that he's making? There's nothing wrong with instrumental music and that kind of thing in the secular realm, but when you bring it in to the church, the motivation for that is, well, we're wanting our worship in church to be more entertaining and more appealing to the senses and all that, like the kind of contemporary secular music that we enjoy and that we listen to and gets us excited and, you know, and touches us and all that. Well, we want our church music to have that same kind of thing. And so the instruments of music are brought in to help with all that. But that's not what the apostles were teaching. And that doesn't comport with that first century simple worship in spirit and truth. So we kind of come down to this. What's wrong with instrumental music in worship? I suggested this morning to you, first and foremost, here's why I think we need to see this as wrong. Because it's not a part of apostolic worship. It's an alteration of apostolic worship. And again, what I've tried to emphasize, what makes it significant when you look at the New Testament, even though the New Testament writers, it's not that they're ever addressing the instrumental music question. It wasn't an issue in the first century. But it's obvious from their writings that it wasn't what they were teaching their first century Christians to do in worship to God. It wasn't a part of their worship services. And so if the apostles of God, whose mission was to teach us what Jesus wants us to do in service to him, if they didn't teach that in the first century, then it's not God's will. And how then can we incorporate something just because, well, we like it, we think it would be good, but it's not in accordance with God's will. It's not part of that apostolic worship. But now, in addition to this, and in conjunction with it, there are some practical problems with instrumental music. Especially what we see in our day, and again, it's kind of been a practical problem for centuries when people have tried to introduce instruments of music into worship. Instruments of music in worship, it takes people's minds away from the words. And keep in mind, when you look at the New Testament and the purpose of singing, Paul is talking about singing and its purpose. And it's very clear that our purpose in worshiping God in song is to give thanks to God and praise His name and to teach and admonish one another. That necessarily means that those words have to be understood. That's the purpose of all of that. You can't have edification if people don't understand what is being said. Paul taught that in 1 Corinthians 14. And when you bring in instruments of music, it takes people's minds away from the words. Now, you may argue with me about that. Let me tell you what. It certainly takes the mind of the instrumentalist away from the words. You may not know this about me, but up through school and college, I was a saxophone player. Alto and tenor sax. Let me tell you what, baby, I was good. Before I decided to preach, I wanted to be a music major. And I wrote music and I performed music. I was in some groups and traveled around the country. And I say that just to say I'm very much inclined toward instrumental music. I mean, I really like it. But I know this, and I play with a lot of groups and singers, and I've accompanied them. You're playing a trumpet, you're playing a trombone, you're playing a saxophone. You're thinking about your musical part. You're not thinking about the words that are being sung. You just can't do that because the very nature of instrumental music is such, it now makes a more complex form of music, and the instrumentalist is having to concentrate upon the notes he's playing and his part in the song musically, and the words that the singers are singing, that's the last thing that he's thinking of. So I know that the instrumentalists themselves, they're not able to really focus in on the words. Now you want to question me about that? Okay, yeah, there are some instruments that you can play and sing at the same time. Like a stringed instrument, like a modern-day guitar, you know, or a piano, or an organ. I'll tell you what, though. Even then, you have to be really good to be able to play that instrument, whether you're strumming a guitar or whether you're playing an organ or piano, and still be singing yourself and thinking about the words and not be distracted by having to play the instrument. You've got to be real good at that. And so again, I want to say to you that when you think about all of this, that the very nature of instruments of music, it takes people's minds away from the words themselves. Certainly makes it difficult, if not impossible, at least difficult for the instrumentalists to be thinking about the words as God was certainly commanding people to do. And even those other people maybe who are not playing the musical instruments, but they're singing and yet or they're listening to all of this. The complexity of the song, now that you're adding the instruments and all that, it becomes such, and if you think about it, you'll see what I'm talking about. You very often get distracted from the words themselves. In fact, if you're an instrumental person like me, I mean, many is the time that my wife and I are listening to some group perform, say, on television or something, just some secular group, you know, and she'll make some comment, you know, that was a neat song. I like the words. And I'm going, oh, really? What were they saying? I wasn't even paying attention to that. I just listened to the music, to the instruments and all that. So this is just a practical issue. It hinders people from really paying attention to the words when instruments of music are incorporated into that worship of God. It becomes a distraction from the real point that God had in all that, are thinking about the words that are being sung. Now let me just parenthetically make a comment. The point I'm making right here, it doesn't just apply to instruments of music. You can sing an a cappella song that is written and composed to be such a complex song with so many different parts and everything, and so difficult for worshipers to be singing that they really can't worship at all as they sing. That's the reason why when we try to learn a song, and you know this, you know, when the song's new to you and you don't really know your part well, can you really be thinking about the words? No, you're trying to figure out how the bass line goes or how the soprano line goes. Now, we do have to learn songs, but we try to make the songs simple enough to where you can learn them rather quickly and easily so that you can then be thinking about the words as you sing your part. But I tell you what, there are some songs that they may sound real pretty, and they're real ornate, and musically they're written with the chords in a very interesting way, and it's real appealing to our senses. But it really takes people's minds away from thinking about the words. That's exactly the same problem with instruments of music. So I think we need to think about that. And I'll tell you then another problem with instrumental music. And it ties in with everything we've been saying. It tends, I'm not saying it always is this way. Please don't, I'm not trying to overstate this. But it tends toward focusing things more on entertainment than on edification. And if you want to disagree with me on that, well, I mean, just look at what you see in the church services, and you've got the big organs, and you've got the groups, and it's a performance. It's a concert. Or think about the contemporary worship that we were talking about a few minutes ago. And the whole point of all this is we're using all this kind of instrumentation that we all enjoy from our popular music, and we now just take some biblical words and phrases, and so we now have verses that have a biblical theme, but we just attach all the kind of pop kind of instrumentation to it, and now it's contemporary, and it's more exciting, and it's more entertaining. But what are we doing? We're pushing everything more toward entertainment than really worshiping God and edifying one another with these spiritual truths. And that's the very point that some of these ancient writers I've showed you excerpts from that they were trying to make. And so we need to really think about all of this. What's wrong with instrumental music? It's not part of apostolic worship. And it's significant that it was obviously not a part of apostolic worship. And it tends to take people's minds away from the words being sung very easily. And it tends to kind of move toward more of an emphasis on entertainment than edification. Now I'm going to close this evening, if you will bear with me, by telling you this story. Several years ago, I get a call, young preacher here in Tampa. And John Knox Village over here, the old folks' home there. Preacher said, I was asked to preside over a little service that they had there. And I can't do it. And Marty wanted to know if you could go over there this Sunday afternoon and do it. And so I said, well, sure. Maybe it'd be a chance to kind of make some contacts on those people, preach the gospel there, maybe, you know. And the thought went through my mind. Well, at that John Knox Village, that kind of service that they're trying to have, a generic kind of service there, are they going to have an instrumental music? But the fellow who had called and asked me, well, he knew that I didn't believe in instrumental music. So I thought, well, surely he wouldn't have asked me to do it if that's what they used. Unbeknownst to me, he'd never been there before. He'd agreed to do it, but hadn't been there yet. And he called me to ask me to fill in because he couldn't go. I misunderstood. I thought he'd been doing this for a long time. So I go there, and there's this recreation room there in the John Knox Village, and I go in, and there's a piano over there, you know. So I'm thinking, this rec room, that's not for everybody. So all of the elderly folks start coming in, you know, about 30, 40 people there. And so they come in, they have a seat, and here's Miss Betty that comes over to me, and she explains, now, after you give the lesson, we always have the preacher then start our worship. So if you'll do that, okay, fine. Yeah, she comes up. So I'm kind of, okay, you know, something. Okay, I'm going to lead him in some songs. And I noticed Miss Betty goes over to the piano and takes her seat. Well,
intelligent fellow that I am, I began to think I may be in trouble here. So I gave my lesson and got done with that. And I look over at Miss Betty, and she's at the piano, and she's like. And so I did one of these, help me, Lord, here, And I said, folks, listen, I really appreciate you asking me to come and to speak for you, and it's a pleasure for me to be here. And I realized that apparently the preachers that normally come, they lead you then in some songs. But I see that you have an instrument. And I said, I personally, in my conscience, can't do that. I don't believe that that's correct. I'm not going to impose my conscience on you. But I said, if you'll give me just 1 minute, let me explain why I have a problem with that, and then I'm going to go have a seat and let you do this. And so I explained why, and I gave a little synopsis of what I've talked about in today's lessons. And I got done with that, and I said, so I'm just going to have a seat because I don't want to try to force my conscience on you. And I look over there, and there's Miss Betty. And she's waiting on me to start, And then she realizes, I'm not going to start. And I go have a seat. And she just gets this mad look on her face. And she starts playing, And so they all, sing, their songs and all this, Well, so the service is over with. And, I'm standing there in the back. That's what preacher's supposed to do. You have to shake people out. So I'm there in the back. And so here's these elderly people. And they're coming, their walkers and their canes, And I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, what are they going to say to me? Elderly lady comes up to me in her walker. Never forget this, as long as I'm living. She says, Brother Pickard, I've never thought about what you were saying before about instruments and music and not being in first century worship and so we shouldn't be using those words. I've never thought about that before, but I really appreciate you giving me that to think about. And I'm going to think about that. Oh, well, what do you know? What do you know? Next lady comes along. Brother Pickup, what you were saying about instruments and music not being in the first century and we shouldn't be using those instruments and music now? I never thought about that before. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. Well, you win some and you lose some. I say that to you. I tell you that story. Because that's kind of the reaction. That epitomizes kind of the two reactions that people have to this. And with a lot of people, it just seems silly. It just, come on, it makes the worship just so much better and more enjoyable and, drowns out all the people with bad voices. And let's just bring more instruments in, But then there are other people who, They say, but God is the one we worship. And God ought to have the right to decide how we worship. And if the apostles weren't teaching that in the first century, and they had it in Greco-Roman worship, they had it in Jerusalem temple worship, but the apostles weren't teaching it for the first century Christians, that ought to say something to us. And some people are going to see that. And they're going to have the attitude that says, I'm going to make sure that I'm worshiping God in the proper way and doing what is right. And that, I think, is the attitude that we need to have. Not everybody's going to agree with that. And that's going to be sometimes the first question that people want to ask when they come into our service, because it seems very odd to them. They're so used to this, and they don't realize this has been an issue throughout the centuries. But it does give us a springboard to try to talk with people and talk to them about the fundamental principle of God's the object of worship, and we're trying to go back to the Bible and worship Him in accordance with His will. And even if the ways that God has come up with us to worship Him don't appeal to our sense of entertainment or other kinds of human wisdom, we need to let God be God. So I thank you for listening to me. I hope these lessons have been helpful to you. I wonder if there's someone tonight who needs to respond to the gospel of Jesus Christ. If we can assist you in any way, won't you come while together we stand and sing this song?